Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. Our guest today is Tab Ramos, the men's U20 coach and the men's youth technical director for U.S. soccer. Under his guidance, the U20s have now qualified for the 2019 World Cup in May, and they defeated Mexico 2-0 the day before Thanksgiving to win the CONCACAF Championship. That's our second straight U20 CONCACAF crown under Ramos, who is back in Florida this week to watch the U17s at the Nike Friendlies. Tab, thanks for joining me, and thanks for helping to provide light in the darkness for men's national team fans.
Hi, thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Congratulations on a dominant showing in Bradenton. Why don't you give us the story of the tournament from your perspective?
Well, I mean, first of all, it was, you know, difficult to put the team together, obviously, because of the timing of the tournament. So we had a number of different issues to deal with. You know, the first one, obviously, with colleges, because we had to make a decision on the players that we were going to select from college already months ago. So with the hope that they would be in good form at this time. So that's a chance that you kind of have to take in the summer, because obviously because of school schedule, it's not easy to, it's not easy to organize and set up. So we committed to some college guys, late July. I think we committed to the right ones, and fortunately it worked out pretty well for them. We also then had the issues of the MLS playoffs. So some of the players, Chris Durkin and Carlton, we had the issue of having them involved in the playoffs. So there were players that we couldn't necessarily count on. And so having said that, we also had to go. I had to personally go and visit many of the German clubs and ask for their player releases in the middle of the season, which is also not difficult. I mean, not easy. So there was a number of different issues that we had to deal with just to put the roster together. So finally, now, fast forward to about, 5-6 weeks ago, we get the team together in Florida, and I think we had a good group. We were a very young team. We had 11 players out of the 23 that we ended up using in the tournament who were younger than the actual age group. So I think we were likely one of the younger teams in the tournament, but good players. The one thing I've remained consistent on over the last at least, 3 to 4 years is that I believe in our players. I think we have good players, and whether we're younger or not, I think we pick good ones, and I felt good about our team.
Yeah, for sure. 46-2 goal differential is hard to argue with. It looked like the boys were a little more flowing in possession, starting against Suriname in the fifth game of the group, and from then on, while the earlier games were a little more choppy. Am I imagining that, or did that reflect different tactics, better cohesion on the team?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you saw the games. Our tactics didn't change.
Okay.
We always wanted to be the proactive, high-pressing team that had the ball all the time. If you look at the numbers, and you look at games previous to that, there were some games where we had possession of the ball 75-78% of the time and completed, anywhere between 500 and 600 passes. So if I'm not necessarily big on stats. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the times statistics, you can make them look to, like whatever you want them to look like. But the fact is we did have the ball a lot, and we did have the ball a lot on the opposing team side of the field. The difficult part sometimes is, we play teams that just, for the most part, wanted to make the game ugly and weren't going to give us anything. And so, at that point it makes it a little bit difficult when you have teams in the tournament that, because we had a better team, they defend at the top of their box, basically, or within 30 yards of their goal with, all 10 field players, and that makes it difficult to create. So we had to come up with, with different ways to break them down. And it doesn't always look as pretty, but what I can tell you, Adam, is that we didn't change our tactics. We might've changed the way we attacked certain parts of the field at different times, because we felt we had better matchups in different places, but But our you know, our tactics are the same. We're high pressing teams. We want to have the ball. We want to create. We want to score a goal and then go score another one. So that really hasn't changed.
Okay. So what do you like about the 4-3-3? I want you to feel free to be as nerdy and technical here as you feel comfortable with. Your teams have been very consistent in using it. What are the benefits of that formation?
Well, the benefits of that are, you know, for us from a you know, as you know, I'm the youth technical director, so I sort of oversee all the youth national teams, and it gives us a good uniform way to teach the game to the players. You know, the positions in a 4-3-3 are very, very precise. So if you're a right back, you know what's required of you. If you're a number six, you know specifically what the requirements are for you. Same as if you're an 8 or a 10, or, you know, the 7 and 11 being wingers are, you know, two players that for the most part we'd like on the youth national teams. We'd like for those two players to have sort of their heels on the line all the way outside to open the field as much as we can. You know, our 9 is very much an in-the-box type of player. So it's very clear for us to get a message across to all our players, considering that, you know, our preparation time is you know, is very short. You know, with the U-20 team, for example, going into qualifying, we only had the full team only 2 days before our first game. So Wow. We really grew as the tournament went on. And we're teaching us. So we're handing out pamphlets of positional, you know, training, and we're kind of teaching the players on the run, you know, on video and on, you know, and on the screen and by giving them materials. And, you know, fortunately we've had the players in the past. So, you know, if you have that continuation from youth national team to youth national teams, then it becomes a lot easier when the players come in. They're not seeing something completely new. And I think we're starting to benefit from that.
Yeah. It looked that way. Since this group just won a trophy together, I assume it will be tough to leave anybody out of the World Cup roster. Who are the other guys who weren't there you'd really like to have at the World Cup, you know, all things equal?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I'll throw names, but I will throw names in the sense of just, you know, saying that we recognize those are good players and they could potentially help us. Okay. Because I also don't want to disrespect the guys who had a great tournament. And as you said, they may not be replaced. Maybe none of them are replaced, although that would be highly unusual because in this age group, there may be one or two players who end up going to the World Cup in June that I still don't even know about yet. So there are players that may come along in a league in the spring playing in Holland or playing in Germany. You know, with all the homework that we do, there's always somebody that seems to pop up somewhere.
Right.
And so we don't know. But, I mean, look, we have a lot of good players out there. And, you know, you can go obviously from the obvious, which is, you know, Andrew Carlton to the Durkins of the world to even Conrad De La Fuente, who's a younger player, to Flo Balogun, who's still playing for England. I don't know what's going to happen with him. He's playing for England at the U18s, but he also played for us at the U18s. There's a number of players that I think can come in and be competitive with the players that we have on this team.
Okay. How is the player pool in this cycle different from the pool for the last cycle in terms of strengths and weaknesses on the field in the roster?
I think it's similar. I think the last group that we had, we were very gifted in the central defender position, which was unusual. So we had, you know, obviously Vickers was there, but Palmer Brown was there and Tommy Redding was there and Justin Glad was there. And then Trusty was there. And, you know, and so we had a lot of players who could potentially just be starters the whole time. And you can only, you know, you can only play two and you can potentially only take with you three. So if you're going to take more than three, now you got to think of other positions for players. And, you know, one of the ways I look at our teams always is I like to have as many good players as I can on the field at any given time. So if I have to put a player, you know, to play out of position somewhere else, I'd rather give him the experience to play out of position than to have him on the bench for a player who maybe is not as good playing in the right position. And maybe, you know, maybe this is something that down the road I need to correct. I don't know if I need to, but I know that I'm in a place where, you know, at the same time as for winning, I'm also here for the development of our players. And I like to provide our best players as many opportunities to be on the field as possible.
Very cool. If you may not want to answer this question, but I'll shoot anyway. If you had Alex Mendez, Richie Ledesma, Brandon Cervania, Chris Durkin, Torres, Carlton, Weah, Ulianez, Amaya, Paxton Pomacall, and Ayo Akinola all available for a game you had to win.
And Sargent.
Yeah, and Sargent. I'm deliberately leaving strikers out of this question, but who would be your starting midfield three and your wingers?
I can't have all of them. You're saying I cannot have all of them on the field and make a couple of them outside the back?
Yeah. I mean,
look, the answer is a really difficult one because that's likely going to come up in May. And I think, you know, sometimes as difficult as our job is, it sort of falls. It falls into the right spots because inevitably in May, not all of those guys will be in good form. Not all of them will be ready to contribute to the team. And so although they're all great players, I don't think there's one player of all the names you mentioned that I wouldn't want to have on my team. But the bottom line is the guys in best form at the particular time are going to go to the World Cup because that's just sort of how it works. You know, in the past, I've had to leave guys that I really liked, and not necessarily guys who made it. So let's take example, Junior Flores, for example, in the past. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He used to be our best U-17 player, you know, and at the end of the day, he did well in qualifying for us. But when we got to go to the World Cup, he was not in good form. And he was not in better form than other guys that we had on the field, you know, and same goes for guys like Christian Roldan. I love Christian Roldan. He's a great player and he has become a great pro. And at the time, you know, he was just not in the same form as some of the other guys who were ahead of him. So, you know, I tell the players all the time, look, I can only pick, and especially in the midfield position, I can only pick four or five of you guys. I can't pick any more. I wish I could take you all. Bottom line is I'll take the best, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to be a great 10-year pro if you don't make this team. It just means that at this particular moment, somebody else beats you out for a position for what the team needs at this particular time. That's all. And that's a hard lesson, really, for players, especially young players, because inevitably they're going to think, hey, coach didn't pick me. He must think I'm no good. And that's so far from the truth, but it's, you know, it's hard to justify when you don't pick someone. You know, inevitably as a coach, you always feel bad when you don't take a good player because there are many good players that have left off rosters in the past.
Right. Well, last question specifically about the U-20s. Is it possible that any one player could play in both the U-20 World Cup and the Gold Cup? Is that possible?
That's really not a question. Is it possible? Absolutely. In particular because the U-20 World Cup is before the Gold Cup.
Right.
If one of our players does great, scores three goals a game, we win the World Cup, I would imagine there's going to be a few of them going to the Gold Cup. But I can't answer that question because that would have to be answered by whoever's in charge of the senior national team.
Okay. All right. Going away from the U-20s, what does the youth technical director role entail day to day so far? And so far, how does it intertwine with Ernie Stewart's role as GM?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And so my role every day is to be in touch with all our youth national team coaches, to keep making sure that we're implementing our style of play, that we're teaching sort of the same way. At the same time, I want the coaches who come in to have freedom. So although we have a particular way of playing with all the youth national teams, it's very narrow in terms of like how much give, the coaches have, you know, it's clearly a 4-3-3. We don't necessarily ask for the coaches to do the same thing every time. So, you know, although someone may get hired for the, you know, say U-17 national team, and we say, hey, look, this is our default start style of play. This is how we play. We play in a 4-3-3. These are the profiles for all our players. This is what we're looking for. This is what we look in each position. At the end of the day, if you're playing Brazil tomorrow and you feel like you need to play 4-4-2 or 3-6-1 or whatever it is, you know, that's why you're the coach of the team. That's your choice. But just know that the team is built this way. And this is sort of how we play, because this is what's best for our players. But if any one particular game, you know, you have to change, then you have to change. There was there's a great coach. His name is Xavier Azcárraga, who I learned a lot from. He coached in the World Cup, and he's a Spanish coach. Coach Athletic Bilbao in Valencia. And he told me one day that you can always answer any soccer question by saying it depends. And it's true. It's very much true, because it always depends. There's so many variables to answering each question that you could literally go on talking forever about what if. But the bottom line is, it's important for me to keep all our teams playing the same way. It's important for us to have contact in terms of the players we're identifying every week from our talent identification department that we work very closely with. And we discuss those players mostly every week. We work on our depth charts for all our youth national teams weekly. So there's many, many little things that we do all the time to keep our youth national teams uniform.
It sounds like a fun job. How much interaction is there with Ernie right now?
Oh, that was the second part of your question. So I met with Ernie many times. Obviously, you know, Ernie has had his hands full, not just because he's obviously new to U.S. soccer, so he's had to learn some of the ropes of the ins and outs of, you know, Soccer House and what happens there, and, you know, and his role there. And then at the same time, you know, obviously busy with the senior national team situation and trying to figure that out, which that obviously, as we all know, falls on him. And then any time he has, we've met quite a few times to discuss youth national teams. I've given him sort of like a full rundown on how we do things, that we've been doing them. And, you know, and from where I sit, I'm always open to suggestions. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, our senior team did not qualify to the World Cup, and that puts us all on our toes. I think in a certain way, the youth national teams have been a little bit unfairly criticized at the same time, because the youth national teams have actually done well. But that's something that comes with the territory, because our senior team didn't qualify. And so I've put all the cards out there, and if there's things that we can do better, that we have to do better, of course, like any coach, we're always trying to improve. So Ernie and I are constantly talking about that.
Okay. Are you going to host a youth summit in January? That seemed like a very fruitful exercise last January.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. That's not something that we can do every year, because different age groups fall with different schedules. And so obviously, as you know, the 17s and 20s have a World Cup. And so we're always waiting to see when qualifying is, because on top of everything else, the World Cup for U20s is normally early summer, and the World Cup for the 17s is usually in the fall. So that throws us for a loop a little bit as far as the cycles, but also the whole dynamic of, you know, all the other teams, and when CONCACAF says that our qualifying has to be, because CONCACAF is constantly changing. So we've had it in March, we've had it in January, we've had it now in November. So the schedule is always thrown off. So the most likely scenario to have a summit, and I agree with you, the summit was amazing. I think it was great, and I'm looking forward to the second one. But I think the summit's best time, it's always in the first year of the cycle, which will be not this January, but the following.
Okay.
Having said that, we will have at the minimum two or three teams in January together, early January. It will likely be, I'll give you that as sort of a news break type thing.
Awesome.
Although it's not 100% confirmed, it is likely that we'll have the 20s and 19s and the 17s, something like that, or the 20s, 18s, 17s, something like that we'll have together in January. We'll have three teams early January.
Awesome. One other youth technical director question is, like, you know, someday you're going to take a different job, I assume. And I wonder if you think the technical director job should eventually be, you know, one that is unified from senior team down to the youth teams, or should it always be sort of split the way it is currently?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, I think, you know, so the way I see it is, if you have a technical director for all of you, U.S. soccer, I think that would work. You know, obviously the senior national team is a whole different animal in itself. But all the youth teams require a lot of work. So I think it can be done. I think U.S. soccer eventually could potentially have one technical director that manages everything. So I don't know. I think the job can be done. I think it's better to have two separate ones. But it could work either way.
Okay. How young do you think the next U.S. World Cup cycle roster will be? I'm pretty deep in this stuff, and I can easily imagine a team that's predominantly under 25. What about you?
You know, I really like our young players, but for the senior national team, to me, it doesn't make a difference. I think for the senior national team, you got to pick the best players and go win games. I think the moment sometimes that you start telling fans, we have an 8-year plan, you risk the fact that the fans may say to you, okay, well, we'll come back and see you in 8 years then. So I really don't know. I think there needs to always be a combination of some young players that you're bringing along. But in general, I think the national team is for the best players today, not the best players 10 years from now.
Okay. Let's see. A few questions about you before I let you go. Grant Wall reported a while back that you were offered the USMNT job on an interim basis, but that you turned it down. Assuming that's true, which you can correct if you want, but if it's true, would you have accepted the job if you knew it was going to last for more than a year?
I will correct that and say that never happened.
Okay.
And now we'll leave it at that.
Okay. Fair enough. With regard to U.S. soccer, this is a big question, but what's changed in the 13 months since the World Cup qualifying failure, and what still needs to change in your view?
In my position, Adam, I can only worry about what I have, and what I have to do is sure my focus is on the under 20 national team and on the rest of the youth national teams. I think we are continuing to make progress on our young teams. And I have to continue to focus on that. I can't answer questions for someone else's job.
Okay. There, I assume I'll get the same answer to this question, but I'm going to shoot anyway. There are rumors out there about you and the FC Dallas job. It seems like a good fit. Does that interest you?
Again, I'm at a place where I'm happy at this point, and but in the world of in the professional world of sports, you never know.
Okay. Last question. It sounds like Alex Mendez, who won the Golden Ball at the CONCACAF Championship, is keeping his options open about whether to play for Mexico or for the U.S., ultimately, assuming he continues to develop as a player and becomes a senior national team player. Now, this isn't your first rodeo with this kind of thing. What's the best way to ensure a player like him stays with the U.S.?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think Alex is thinking at all of switching to go play for anyone else. But yeah, if the question, sometimes also what we have to remember is that these are really young players, and depending on how the question is asked to them, because it would be the same if the question was asked to me about a certain job. If you were to come to me and say, hey, if a job opened up in Spain tomorrow, and Real Madrid wanted you to leave tomorrow right before the World Cup, would you leave? I don't know. I guess I'd leave the door open for that. So you just never know. So is the door open? Yeah, of course. He's a young player. You don't know. There's a lot of hurdles. And Alex and I have discussed this, this particular issue. And I think I'll probably give you the same answer that he's going to give you, is that, Alex is here and he's happy where he is. What's going to happen with Alex years down the road, we don't know. That's the road that he's going to have to cross at that point, depending on what happens in his professional future.
Okay. One last thing. Let me throw one last thing in there. The USL, Alex is a good example of this, but the USL has apparently been a good spot for young guys to get exposure. What do you think of the league as a place for young players to get minutes and test themselves against adults?
I love it. I think the USL is great. I think is the closest thing that we have to being able to match what young players do in other countries. I think, unfortunately, the only issue is if you get signed by a USL team, whether it's from an MLS team or not, that, you know, if you don't make the playoffs in the USL, really at the end of September or first week of October, your season's over. And now you don't play another competitive game until March. That's a really long time. But we've made some really important strides, and our young players are getting a lot of experience in the USL, and I think the USL has been great for them.
Okay. Well, Tab, I know you're busy. Thank you for your time. All the best to you.
All right. Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
Greg and I will be back in a moment to talk about the men's national team and the U-20 CONCACAF Championship. Defensively confused and porous, impotent on the rare occasions when we have the ball, that's the U.S. men's national team right now. The performances against England and Italy were limp, and nobody looked particularly good, except maybe Weston McKennie in the England game and Ethan Horvath in the Italy game. Greg, is there much else to say about these games?
No, I don't want to. I mean, we've both put in our time breaking down like individual player performances and games past. I can't even be bothered to do that. The takeaway I have from these games is that retroactively, like now that we can kind of look at Sarakin's entire run, I think we almost need to give players that we were hard on. We might need to actually cut them some slack because everyone has been performing in sort of this, I want to call it like a tactical wasteland.
Yeah.
So I'm a noted Julian Green critic. I still think he has limitations. Will Trapp's gotten a lot of sort of backlash, I feel like, from his role as the new face of the team. But I think even those guys, we're going to need to give a new grace period to when Greg Berhalter / Tab Ramos / Julian Lopetegui comes in and takes over the team.
/ Tata Martino, maybe. No, that's not going to happen. Yeah, I guess I have one point to make, which is kind of the point that you just made, and then a question. I don't think we can blame the players for the way these last two games went. I'm leaning on the Total Soccer Show a little bit because they watched the Italy game back and came up with a pretty useful tactical discussion of it, I thought. So I recommend you guys listen to that. Most of you probably already do. But in both games, the players looked confused about their defensive responsibilities. And we sort of bent over the England game. But in the Italy game, Cannon and Moore are outside backs in a back five. They didn't step to danger, and they weren't springing forward when we won the ball. So on defense, our midfield three got completely stretched and picked apart. And when we won the ball, which was pretty rare, the midfielders, Delgado, Acosta, and Adams, they didn't have anybody to pass the ball to on the wing. So it's just a total mess. And it's possible.
Yeah, that was,
yeah, go ahead.
That Total Soccer Show breakdown, it was almost uncanny how well it matched up with our discussion that had been going on during the game. There were times I was sending you timestamps, and again, I couldn't go through the effort of like criticizing or documenting the tactics because we know it's Sarakin's last game. But there were these obvious timestamps where the back five was sitting in a back five. Italy were like possessing the ball at the top of their own box under not really any pressure. And our midfield three, which was like a flat midfield three, would get completely stretched, and like Delgado would burst up the field to help Pulisic and Bobby Wood.
Sargent started.
And Italy, I mean, that left like a 60-yard gap where it's just Adams and Acosta were trying to cover the entire rest of the field. The defenders, the outside back, our wing backs weren't stepping up to help them. And Delgado was sort of connecting himself to the front two. And it was just like they make an easy pass around the edge on Delgado's side, and now Delgado had this like 65-70 yard recovery run to make at like a full sprint so that he could help out Shaq Moore on the left side. And it was just, I mean, things we kind of take for granted about player fitness is that everyone's asked to do things in a 90-minute soccer game that the human body is capable of doing. If you're going to have Delgado constantly making 70-yard sprints to recover, he's not going to be the same player he is if he's doing a more reasonable, if he's expending energy in a more reasonable situation.
Yeah, and he looked, it totally makes sense to me. He looked pretty bad. I got, you know, a few people came at me in my mentions about it because I have been rooting for Delgado somewhat publicly. But yeah, he looked really bad in the game, and that was probably part of it. He looked like he had cement in his boots. There was one time where he was trying to run somebody down on the right wing, and he looked like he was running in slow motion after about 30 or 40 minutes of trying to cover 80 yards at a time.
Yeah, it's just such a like failed setup. So, I mean, he's going to look bad there. And then I also talked about with you during the game about how Delgado is very much like a 360-degree rhythm player. And so if you take away those wide options in possession because Moore and Cannon are sitting back and you just give him those vertical forward options of Pulisic and Sargent, he's going to get the ball and he's going to look like a deer in headlights. And again, that's a bizarre thing. Yeah, and he totally did. And we have a ton of evidence that Delgado's not a deer in headlights player on the ball. So you blame the setup. You say he needs to get better if he's going to play in that kind of, or he might need to get better if he's going to be useful. But that's not a good evaluation of Delgado,
right? And probably the same goes for Acosta and Cannon, who I think were the other two guys who looked pretty bad. CCV didn't have a very good game either. It's possible everyone ignored Sarakin's instructions and consistently lost the defensive shape that he had in mind. It's much more likely that they didn't receive good instructions. And either way, it's time for a new coach. Obviously, everybody agrees with that.
The last, I don't know, several, it's been four or five games under Sarakin where when you watch the game, you can't even guess. You can't even guess like what the instructions are, what the tactics are. And that's been a real issue for us making any kind of forward movement with this team, even under an interim coach. It's perfectly fair to criticize a coach's tactics. A great example here is Armas in the playoffs. We'll get to the playoffs later, but Armas in the first leg, Atlanta, New York, widely criticized for its tactics. But you could definitely at least tell what the team was trying to do. There's no question what they were trying to do. The outcome didn't match what he wanted. But we know what the tactics are,
right?
You know what I mean. And so, with this, the last several U.S. games, no idea what assignments are, or what somebody's, job is, their primary job, their secondary job, what they're going to do in transition. Like none of that has been even remotely evident.
And so, I guess that brings me to the question part of what I wanted to say, which is, has the extended nature of the Sarakin era and all the struggles that we have sort of just outlined, has that done damage to the national team? Has their confidence been shot? Is that even possible? Is that just mystical nonsense?
what's your feeling on it? I mean, you kind of know where I stand on the confidence issue, but what's your thought on the Sarakin effect on our national pool?
I mean, it certainly can't help. I guess that's the baseline for me. It doesn't help to go out there without a good plan, game after game against excellent competition, and then be exposed for it. So I think the confidence of these players, these young players, probably has taken a little bit of a shot. And I'm not saying it's shot, but it has taken a shot. I guess that's where I would land on it. It hasn't been good, and maybe it has been. Maybe damage has been done to the player pool.
Yeah, I think the damage is it's still the opportunity cost. Peter Vermees talked about how we lost in Trinidad 13 months ago, and it was a terrible soccer tragedy, but it's also the silver lining, if there was one, is we had a full year where everyone else was focused on the World Cup. We could have been really digging in and creating a plan. I'm big on the plan, creating a plan for, all right, how do we want to fix this? How do we want to advance in the next World Cup? And that just obviously didn't happen. So I'm an opportunity cost guy. I don't think the confidence of the pool is in question at all, because they know Sarakin's not the guy.
Right.
If Sarakin were the actual head coach, I think you would have seen players have lost confidence in Sarakin, and their play would sort of reflect that lack of confidence in their leader. But when you know it's a substitute teacher, and as soon as he's gone, I think you'll have this sort of breath of fresh air when they're at least given an actual system, whether they can succeed in it or not, whether they're, you know, it plays to their strengths or not is to be determined. But to even be given a system where you at least know what you're trying to do, I think you'll sort of see the body language change a little bit.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I guess I will stand firm a little bit on so much of, you know, receiving the ball in traffic and having the confidence to turn and play it is mental and psychological. And I don't know, at 19 and 20 to just get absolutely steamrolled by England and Italy. The Peru and Colombia games weren't quite as discouraging, but the England and Italy games in particular were just atrocious. I hope it doesn't have any lasting effects, but
it'll be a good experiment on what is sort of possible in that realm of changing the aesthetics or changing the style. Where is it possible to sort of overnight, with the right attitude of your coach, if the coach demands it of you, are you able to just be like, okay, I can do this, and we as a team are capable of this, and this is how we're going to play from now on? Or is it like, is there still that self-doubt of like, I'm just not sure, we couldn't do it 6 months ago, there's no way we're just gonna be able to do it tomorrow, we need to just bunker in, or we need to just be that hardworking hustle team?
Yeah. All right. Well, Greg Berhalter may be announced this week. I think that was sort of the latest headline that an announcement could come yet this week. So let's hope for that. And
you know, they're going to announce it the second we finish recording this.
It's probably been announced just now. But beyond that, there have been some interesting takeaways from this window in the national soccer press. And from two guys in particular that I really like, Paul Tenorio and Matt Doyle, both made what point recently? Greg, and I know you have a lot to say about this, so I'll just turn it over to you.
I don't know why this is the thing that gets me so like riled up, but they both very explicitly said, if you're not playing with your club's first team, if you're not getting minutes with your club's first team, you should no longer, the next coach should not call players into the national team.
Yeah.
And that just seems to me like a complete like leap from what we've seen over the past 13 months to have that be your takeaway. I actually like have seen all these games and came up with the exact opposite takeaway of like, we need to evaluate everyone on a case by case basis and be taking the best player. And in fact, if there is a trend line, if there are some tea leaves to be read here, it's that a lot of our completely professionally unproven players have been our most stable contributors or most consistent players.
Yeah, well, just for the sake of documentation, who are you talking about?
So we're talking about the guy. I mean, essentially, the guys Tenorio and Doyle have to be talking about are Tim Weah, who appeared in the first game of PSG season for their first team, he played the first two games. Is that right?
Something like that. And then he hasn't
came off at halftime. Yeah, came off at halftime of their second game of the season. And remember, Mbappe and the World Cup guys were all getting back from their World Cup extended break. Those guys came back. Tim Weah has not been in the 18 since then. Josh Sargent has never appeared in the 18 for Werder Bremen.
Right.
Matt Miazga took a couple of weeks to settle in. Not became a 90-minute lock every week. Had a couple of bad games. Right when they shifted their managers or they changed their manager, and has not appeared in the 18 since. And then I guess the other guy you'd be talking about would be Cameron Carter-Vickers, who is not playing at Swansea City. That's four guys? Two starters, I would say, Miazga and Tim Weah at this point, and two guys who seem to be the next guy up in CCV, who's routinely started in the second game of friendly windows at center back, and Josh Sargent, who really seems to be pushing Bobby Wood for the starting role. And so Tenorio and Doyle are saying no more call-ups for these fellas until they break through. Take me through their thought process, because I'm really struggling with it.
I don't know. I don't really get the thought process. It's, you know, we're all sort of in the business of takes, and it's a take that seemed low-hanging in terms of fruit. and they took it. I guess I don't mind the idea of accountability in the abstract for the player pool. The problem is we don't have the luxury of that kind of accountability, because our player pool over the age of 20 basically sucks. You know, as Brian Shiretta pointed out in his Missing Generation piece a year ago, and many other people have talked about, from 21 and over, it's a bunch of old guys with a lot of accomplishments, and then a very thin pool of national team caliber players between the ages of 20 and 30. So I think we're at kind of a unique time where this call for accountability doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, and I always struggle with this. Like, what's the accountability? Like, what are we saying that Pulisic is doing wrong at Dortmund? Like, the accountability, like, implies that he's not, pushing himself to his full level. Like, Pulisic could well – there are better wingers in the world than Christian Pulisic. Jadon Sancho appears to be one of those players. I switched over to Pulisic because he's another one who's sort of – he's sort of becoming on the fringes of Dortmund's first choice team if he's not completely out of it. And so I go to him because if you're going to have this rule 3 months from now, it could well extend to Christian Pulisic.
Right.
And so he's a guy where I'm like, you could just as easily do it. Josh Sargent. Is Josh Sargent somehow not pushing himself very much just because he's behind other players at Werder Bremen?
Well, yeah. I mean, to go back to Pulisic for a second, if he signs one of these rumored deals for a move in the summer, and it's known that he's on the way out, he's already fallen behind Jadon Sancho and probably Jacob Bruun-Larsen in the winger depth chart at Dortmund. If he's on his way out this summer,
I'm just gonna real quick on the Bruun-Larsen one and whatever. Like, he's behind Bruun-Larsen, and people are going to say it's because the tactics of Dortmund right now call for one more defensive-minded winger. But the reason you play those tactics is because you don't think Christian Pulisic gives you enough in attack to make up for his lack of defending that Bruun-Larsen would give you. But anyway, yes, go on.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's people trot out all kinds of excuses for why Pulisic isn't starting at Dortmund, and those excuses they change shape and they will keep coming. But the point I'm making is, I think you're right. There is a possibility. I don't think it's a probability, but there's a possibility that he could be basically benched in the spring, especially if he signs a deal with another club for a move in the summer. And they're like, well, you're not going to be around next year anyway. You're not producing goals and assists. We have Jadon Sancho, Marco Reus, and Jacob Bruun-Larsen. So anyway, just to flesh that out a little bit, I think that's a possibility.
Yeah, and so what is Christian Pulisic not being accountable for as a player on his development path or on his competition level? Like, what are we trying to say that he's taking it easy, or how does accountability even factor into this?
Yeah. Another way that accountability factors into it or doesn't factor into this point is, if you're in MLS and starting every week for Minnesota United, say you're Brent Coleman, an American center back who's never gotten a call up with the national team, as far as I know, does Brent Coleman all of a sudden leap ahead of Matt Miazga and Cameron Carter-Vickers in the depth chart just because he's playing every minute? And I mean, playing every week. And I guess the larger point is, staying in MLS is the best thing you could do for your national team chances if there were an actual self-imposed first team minutes restriction, because anybody who goes and takes the risk of going to Europe takes their national team caps in their own hands, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So rather than holding players accountable, you're almost saying make sure that you only go into club situations where you are guaranteed to play every minute. Because again, you can work as hard as you want, Tim Weah, and you're not breaking into PSG's front three.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's gotta be case by case. It's gotta be case by case. And as we saw against Peru, Josh Sargent looked like the best striker in the American pool, despite playing in a system that probably didn't make sense. He regularly created chances and danger, and scored the go ahead goal. So,
yeah, and if you want to get into a should Josh Sargent start over Bobby Wood debate, like I think that's a argument with merits on both sides. But that's not even the discussion we're trying to have here. It'd be Josh Sargent doesn't belong in the 23, which means you're actually putting Bobby Wood ahead of him. Fair enough. But you're also putting ahead of him Andrei Novakovic, Giazzi Zardes. Name a guy after that.
Bell. Dom Dwyer.
Dwyer in it over Josh Sargent. So you have Josh Sargent, who's looked our most effective striker in his limited minutes. He's looked the most effective striker for the U.S. since sort of Jozy Altidore during peak Jozy Altidore years. Yeah. And now we're immediately going to say, all right, that's all great, we've got this data, but we're going to ignore it because you're not in the 18 for some reason. Again, I think the conclusion is the exact opposite, and that you say we need to get data on these guys who are on the fringes, because it's very possible they give us the best chance to win the Gold Cup, which gives us the best chance to play, which gives us the Confederations Cup, which helps us in our goal to advance in the World Cup. And you only sort of make decisions based on their effect on your long-term plan of advancing in the World Cup, and excluding players who would help that plan is sort of that cutting off the nose situation.
Yeah. Well, we're in agreement. It's a silly take, and there's no guarantee Josh Sargent will get first team minutes in Bremen next spring. But he still should be, you know, very much in the mix for the Gold Cup. Probably should be called up for the Gold Cup.
Yeah, Josh Sargent, Christian Pulisic, if he moves to Chelsea, and Tyler Adams' situation will be unknown at Red Bull Leipzig.
Very strong chance Tyler Adams will not play right off the bat.
Potentially add Zach Steffen to that list. We're going to leave all those guys off of the Gold Cup roster because Lyndon Gooch is starting every week at Sunderland.
Okay, let's move on to the U-20s, unless you got more to say about that.
Let me just do one thing. I'll tweak that take just a hair, and then totally be on board with it. If you just tweaked it to sort of try to give U.S. fans perspective, and you said, until our best players have broken into their first teams, until our top 11 players are actually first-team starters at these solid European clubs, we shouldn't really expect the U.S. to be competitive against England and Italy. If you were saying that, I'd be like, yeah, that's probably fair. I mean, we got to be realistic about where our pool is at the moment, and that's where we are. But that's not what we're saying. We're saying don't play these guys, and somehow that helps the U.S. advance its cause.
Right. That's a good segue, because the over 20 pool is pretty weak. The under 20 pool, as always, is full of promise. And when we come back, we'll talk about their CONCACAF championship.
If you love me half as much as I love you, you wouldn't worry me half as much as you do.
All right, we're back. The U-20s beat Mexico 2-0 to win the CONCACAF championship the day before Thanksgiving. And it was a happy night for me. I think for close observers of American soccer, it was a happy night too, especially after the debacle of the 1-0 loss to Italy the day before.
We needed that dose of optimism as we were all getting a little close to the ledge.
Yeah. The game against Mexico was decided by two delightful goals from Alex Mendez, 18-year-old midfielder who was on this podcast a few weeks ago, so check that out if you haven't already. He scored one in each half, both assisted by Paxton Pomykal, and the U.S. won pretty comfortably over Mexico. It wasn't it wasn't total domination, but it was we were clearly the superior team on the night.
Yeah, that's fair.
Let's talk about the two goals. First goal, long kick from goalkeeper Brady Scott, who also had a good tournament, headed down by Justin Renix, who started over Sebastian Soto in the game because Soto had started two games in the previous 6 days. Renix played well again, and he headed it down to Frankie Amaya, who was slotted in next to Mendez in the midfield. Amaya took a touch and played Paxton Pomykal down the wing. Pomykal, who was bright and dribbly with the ball at his feet throughout the tournament, dribbled a defender into the box, cut in on his right, which he can shoot with, as he's shown in this tournament. And then he just passed it to the top of the box where Mendez was demanding the ball. Mendez struck it first time, hits a low, flashing 20-yard shot into the far corner. Quality finish, 1-0, USA.
Yeah, a lot of credit to Paxton Pomykal here because it was his sort of initiative that created the room in the box, and then it was his execution that created the shot. Really smart movement from Alex Mendez to not crowd the issue, essentially giving Pomykal an area at the top of the box to put the ball that Mendez could then run onto it, take 2-3 steps, and really hit it where he wanted to. But also a really good layoff by Pomykal. He didn't play at two Mendez's feet. He just sort of set it up for him. He essentially took Mendez's first touch for him.
Yeah.
And then Mendez still had a lot to do because he's at the top of the box, traffic between him and goal. So really savvy finish to find the lane that the keeper would be unsighted, and probably the goalkeeper assumed that area of the goal was already taken away by a defender. And Mendez just buried it.
Yeah, what a great shot.
Impressive. Yeah, good finishing instincts from both Mendez. And again, I kind of credit Pomykal with having some finishing instincts there to set up that finish.
It makes me think, is there anybody in the pool that you would rather have with a little bit of space at the top of the box than Mendez? You know, I mean, he has his limitations as a player. We've talked about his defending on this podcast, but man, with a little bit of room at the top of the box, it just feels like he's going to score. At least it did in this tournament.
Bells, are you talking about anyone in the pool, in the full pool, or anyone in the U20 pool?
Anyone in the full pool. Who's got that ability to score from distance?
It's a good question. I kind of need to think about it. Julian Green comes to mind.
Green is the one who comes to mind for me too.
He has a good strike.
He does. He'll hit it well from distance. But I think he's kind of the only one. I mean, Pulisic's not going to do it. McKennie and Adams aren't really – they haven't really shown that ability. Maybe Josh Sargent. Bobby Wood.
Is it kind of depressing that we – you think Kellen Acosta surely has that, doesn't he?
Yeah, I don't think he hits the ball as sweetly as Mendez does, though.
Acosta needs a dead ball to hit. All right. Yeah, you're right, though. We don't have some guy always hits the right. Like the other guy I think of is Darlington Nagbe, and he's not like a prolific finisher by any stretch. But you can see, I guess when I see Nagbe attempt to finish from distance, you sort of see those wheels turning in his head of how he's going to get it there, who he's going to curl it around. He just isn't in that situation very often. And usually he decides to try to set somebody else up instead, often incorrectly.
Right. Good day for him on Sunday, though.
Yes.
The second goal was also Pomykal to Mendez. This one was even prettier, I think. Pomykal received a pass just inside his own half and dribbled past a Mexican opponent far too easily for the discriminating viewer, I think. But he did it, and then he galloped toward the edge of the box, kind of runs into a dead end, sort of like the first time a little bit, and lays it off for Mendez, sort of just backwards from just inside the box. This time, Mendez feints like he's going to shoot and takes a touch to his left and then initiates a 1-2 with, with Pomacall. Plays it to Pomacall's feet kind of cleverly and quickly, and then Pomacall just flicks it back to him in behind the line. Mendez runs through. He's free in with the keeper, and he tucks it through the keeper's legs to effectively end the game. That one was really fun to watch, I thought.
Yeah, that was like some indoor soccer stuff, because it was crowded. They're like the first combination on the first goal, Pomacall's threat, running forward, had sort of forced the entire defense to collapse. So there was essentially a giant lane from Pomacall to Mendez, giant in terms of
when
you're at the top of a box, usually those things are. In the second one, there were no real lanes. Like, even their little combinations, I think they had to give little, like, they had to lift the ball off the ground to get it through the sea of legs. Just slightly. And yeah, everything about that was great. And there were no like fluke or lucky like deflections that just happened to go their way. Like, everything happened as designed, with zero margin for error. So that was really, those were really crisp. That was a really crisp sequence for the second one.
Yeah. It brought me off my couch, scared my kids a little bit.
It kind of is. It almost like surprises you to see players in US uniforms do that.
Totally. We haven't seen enough of that. So Mexico barely threatened, though they did nearly score on a set piece in the first half. I thought it was interesting that Diego Lainez was totally neutralized in the game, and was kind of embarrassed by Sergino Dest in one sequence that was sort of widely disseminated on Twitter, where Dest dispossessed him and then kind of pirouetted around him and left it for a teammate.
That clip is going to be on so many calls for Dest to get a first team call up in the next 12 to 15 months before Dest finally gets his first team call up.
Yeah, well, it's funny. A Mexico fan responded with the clip of Lainez pantsing Will Trapp in the friendly in September. So there's your contrast.
There you go. There you go. Dest is our new holding mid.
Dest had a good game this morning. For Ajax, their U19s and UEFA Youth League. Anyway, he was very good in this tournament. I thought top to bottom, Mexico was not great, especially with Lainez having a pretty off game. But still, it's nice to get a trophy and to see an American team that can possess the ball, defend, and score lovely goals.
Mexico was good enough. You know, I mean, Mexico was in their first six games probably of the tournament. There was no team we played that was really going to be capable of punishing us in any meaningful way. And Mexico definitely was. I mean, those were two like comparable teams. It wasn't a complete mismatch. And I think we really did take a comparable opponent and pretty comfortably beat them.
Yeah. Yep. I'd say add in Richie Ledesma, probably Andrew Carleton, maybe Chris Durkin, and maybe George Bello, and we have our World Cup roster. Jonathan Amon would be a big help, but in my opinion, he's needed on the senior team, and Tab has a lot of wingers at his disposal. Maybe even Tim Whale.
Yeah, that makes a difference right there, right? The fact that if Amon's not there, well, I guess we have to settle for Yuli Yanez, so we're not like the drop off isn't as steep as it might be going from Durkin to the next six. And that's a credit to Durkin. But I mean, is that kind of your thought process?
Yeah, that's my thought. Although I am sort of evolving on Cervania versus Durkin, which we can talk about a little bit when we bring up Cervania later. I you know, it's going to be tough for Ramos to make those calls in any case, because this team seems to have pretty good chemistry, and it'd be kind of heartbreaking to take any one of these guys and send him home after they performed so well in this tournament, as easy as most of the competition was. Let's talk about the players who looked the most interesting. Maybe why don't you start?
Okay. I mean, top of the list is Alex Mendez. For me, it sort of checked all the boxes I'm looking for, and I'm pretty demanding in youth tournaments on what I need to see. It's not like he was flawless, but he was a player who was most likely to control a game. He was most likely to make the key play when it was needed. And I thought he just made everyone else probably look a little bit better too.
Yeah, I think the the 8 goals and the 4 assists are kind of the headline, and you know, his dead balls and the goals he scored in the championship game that we've just discussed. But his ability to find a quick, effective pass in the midfield is what really sets him apart for me. He's just a smart distributor of the ball, and he finds clever passes. You know, he finds passes that cancel out a few defenders in a surprising way, and he does that consistently. You know, anytime he got on the ball, there was a good chance that was going to happen.
And that's what you've got to do. You have to look like you're, when you're playing other U20s, you have to look like you're toying with them. Like, you already know what they're going to do. You already know what mistake they're about to make, and you exploit that. Mm-hmm. And I thought Mendes did a really solid. Mendes definitely was the guy who was doing that most often.
The weaknesses he has are probably he's a little slow, and his defensive stoutness, I think, could be questioned in this tournament. I mean, how much are you going to get stuck in when you're up 5-0 against the U.S. Virgin Islands?
And people were going after him, too. People were wrecking it. He got wrecked so often. And I'm hoping that he was sort of exaggerating it a lot, as it would be a smart tactic for him to take to try to minimize some of that punishment. But he was getting physically punished.
Well, everything, almost all of our danger came through his feet. So if I were the opponent, I would punish him, too.
Those weaknesses could really hold a player like Mendes back if the long-term U.S. plan from a Berhalter or whoever takes over is more of a emphasis on conceding possession. You know, I mean, like, I'm just thinking long-term for these guys. If we're going to be a concede possession, cover a lot of ground in midfield, and then break, that wouldn't be the ideal setup for an Alex Mendes. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. Who knows how Berhalter's what system he's going to institute. But yeah, if we're kicking the ball long consistently and, you know, trying to win possession up the field and then score in transition, or
even if we're 3-5-2, like low block, and then win it and break and just be mean as hell, when the other team finally makes a mistake, that might also not suit, a Mendes type.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, he may already be thinking about this because he has left his options open with regard to playing for Mexico. He told Ives Galarsep and Kevin Baxter that he hasn't really decided about his long-term decision. He was pretty noncommittal when he was interviewed on this podcast. He talked about opportunity, whoever, you know, whatever place he gets the most opportunity. For the reasons you and I just discussed, we don't know if he's going to end up being an international caliber player, but he looked like the most likely to on this roster. And I think our friend Matt Hartman said it best. If Mendes plays for Mexico, you'll find me in the East River. We all have our own rivers. Mine just happens to be the father of waters, the Mississippi River. And there's a very tall bridge near my house.
Oh, it's bleak. It's bleak. There are, after the last 12 months, there aren't a ton of bright spots. But Mendes in this U20 tournament, definitely a bright spot. A couple other bright spots. Bells, you take the next one.
Chris Richards, for me, the second most promising player. I may be in the minority putting him ahead of Dest, but I thought Richards transformed us from a fairly susceptible side defensively to a side that was nearly impenetrable. He sees danger developing very early, and he has the tools and the calmness to intervene and snuff it out. It's a combination of calmness and sort of quick decision-making that I really liked from him. The question I have on him is, how much can he be trusted on the ball in tight spots, and how much can he penetrate the opponent's lines with his passing? I think those are his opportunities for improvement.
And contrast him to McKenzie then, because McKenzie was sort of the other locked-in center back until Richards got there. What did Richards look better than McKenzie for you?
Yeah, I did. I thought so. I thought he's just a better defender. He was just quicker to snuff things out than McKenzie. And now McKenzie did have a couple of nice line breaking passes in the tournament, and most notably on that screamer from Mendes.
Yeah.
But it just seems like Richards is seeing the game more quickly than McKenzie. I can't prove that unless I go back and do a million GIFs, which I'm not going to do, but that's my take.
I'm just gonna ask one more question to press you on a little bit, because I think people want to get your sort of analysis on these kids, because you spend a lot of time watching them. Do you think it's a almost like a give and take, where it's Richard's job to snuff the, I mean, the center backs might have slightly different roles, where it's Richard's job to sort of take, I don't know if I'd say more risks, but have a little more freedom to make those decisive movements to snuff things out, and McKenzie's job might be to sort of be the center fielder and keep everything in front of him? Or do you think it's just a situation where Richards is a stronger sort of in all facets? Defensively.
Yeah, I think it's the latter, although I acknowledge it's possible there was some division of responsibility there. I've watched a lot of McKenzie, and that's one of my gripes with him, is his reactions are a little bit sluggish to danger or to what's developing around him. You don't see that with Richards. I mean, there's a loose pass goes out to the wing, and he sees that maybe his fullback is pushed up, and he just comes flying out and just boots it out of bounds, you know, problem solved. I mean, I felt like there were probably a dozen of those instances, not that exact instance, but of that sort of quick reaction and just decisive intervention in those two games that he started and played in, which were, I believe, the Honduras game and the Mexico game, because he didn't play against Costa Rica. So it just seems like I saw a lot of that from him. It's not like it never happened with McKenzie, but just the concentration of instances from Richards were really impressive to me.
Sure. And maybe it's even McKenzie's still making the right decisions when he doesn't go, because maybe he doesn't have the first step that Richards had. So Richards might just be able to do more of those things because of some of the tools he has.
Could be, yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the really what I consider like one of the more exciting additions to the roster.
Yeah, go for it.
Sergino Dest came in, and he looked like he was trying to compile like a YouTube flicks and tricks video all in one tournament. we're using him at right back for the U20s. He's been playing winger for his Ajax U19s and sporadically with the Ajax reserve team in the second division of Holland. And he was bringing, he brought some skills with him. He brought his whole bag of tricks. And it was just, again, he looked like he was toying with guys, and that's exactly what I wanted to see. And he gave us a lot of that.
Yeah, for sure. He's been playing a little winger in Holland, but my understanding is that that's just to improve his on ball quality, you know, or his attacking third bite. I think the long term plans for Ajax are for him to be a right back, and he played right back for the U19s this morning against Athens in UEFA Youth League. So I think that's his long term position, and he's a great 1v1 defender. In addition to the bag of tricks, you know, I think he was just absolutely locked down in that right flank of ours. I was really encouraged by that. He has a great first step. He seems to read the game well. Extremely comfortable in possession. Kind of seems like the complete package, really, as a fullback.
Yep. Yeah. Definitely. He's looked that part in the U20 setting. Really. I mean, he's going to be another one that we can add to our very excited list for the winter, spring of 2019 to watch him in his club situation. Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, if he's going to get minutes at fullback for Ajax, which is a high, and goes without saying, kind of a high standards environment, he probably needs to introduce a little more danger in the final third. And I think that's why they've been playing him at wing. He was a little bit threatening for the U.S., but didn't see any, if I'm not mistaken, I didn't see any end product either with assists or goals, or even like the assist before the assist. And I watched Ajax play on Saturday, and their Argentine left back, Tagliafico, you know, he played a perfect bent ball into Klaas-Jan Huntelaar for the game's final goal. I mean, just a polished, finished product. from the left.
That would probably have shown up in an Eric Palmer Brown GIF, right?
It did, yeah. It was the one that Eric Palmer Brown was responsible for. So Des probably isn't there yet.
But if we're looking like a best case for Dest to get minutes, a quick Eredivisie summary. Ajax and PSV are kind of locked in a two-team race, and Ajax is a little bit behind PSV. Best case for Dest is that PSV manages to sort of run away from Ajax a little bit for the Dutch league. Ajax is in no danger of falling into third, and they have Europa League games to contest as well. So then Dest might be called upon to spell and essentially take some of those league minutes at right back. That's our best case scenario.
Hey, this is Bells from the future. Ajax has advanced to the knockout rounds of the Champions League, so correction on that. A couple of other players we should mention. Brandon Cervenia doesn't quite rise to the level of the other three, but he was very good in this tournament at the six. And the point I wanted to make about the contrast between him and Durkin is, you know, Cervenia's range was important cover for Mendes, whose defensive limitations we've discussed. And then Amaya, who's not, you know, he's a little guy. He's a technical midfielder. He's not a big bruising midfielder. So Cervenia's ability to cover a lot of ground and help snuff things out was important for this roster. And, you know, if it's going to be Mendes and Ledesma at the World Cup at the 8 and the 10 or the 8 and the 8, whatever you want to call it, it's going to be the same dynamic. And it may be that Cervenia is the guy because he covers so much ground and he's good enough at a lot of the other stuff needed for the job. You know, pretty good passer, pretty good. I mean, he can shoot from distance. So I wonder how Tab's going to work that out.
So in a more traditional sort of double pivot, you'd want Durkin over Cervenia, but if it's just going to be, you're going to rely a lot on one guy to cover a lot of the midfield, it's Cervenia might have that edge.
Yeah, I thought that's kind of how it played out in this tournament for the U.S. I mean, when Juan Pablo Torres came on between Mendes and Cervenia, he covered a lot of ground too. But when it was Amaya, it was the defensive midfield responsibilities fell pretty heavily on Cervenia's shoulders. Who can say? Who can say? Durkin's an MLS starter for, you know, he got like 12 MLS starts this year. So he may just be on another level than Cervenia, but that's something to consider, is that Cervenia covers a lot of ground and Durkin really doesn't, not as effortlessly.
Okay, and we might be seeing Cervenia kick off in FC Dallas's new USL team. So he'll have a place to play some professional ball this coming season. Is that?
Well, he played for the Tulsa Roughnecks, I think, the last year.
Oh, okay.
The hope, you know, he was on loan there, and they were pretty bad. The hope is he can break into that first team. You know, we'll see. He's one of the many guys on this team that we'll be watching for progress from. You want to take the next one?
Yeah. So Yuli Yanez, really impressive in the minutes he got, and he played almost every game in the first five games. I feel like they were really, he didn't necessarily start every game, but they were calling on him a lot. Mm-hmm. And then he got like his legs blown up against Honduras in the game where against Costa Rica, right?
That's right. Yeah. After he scored.
Yeah. In the game where Costa Rica really honestly did seem to lose the plot completely and just started targeting guys' legs. Yuli was the one who suffered the most damage. So he didn't play against Honduras and then wasn't nearly as effective against Mexico as he looked earlier in the tournament. Part of that might be Mexico's better, but it's easy to think that he wasn't 100%.
Yeah, I don't think he was.
But in the time that he was on the field before that injury against Costa Rica, the dude was electric. And it was, again, it's like, it's not just electric for the competition. Like, he was doing shit that would have been impressive on an empty field just by himself. And he was pulling it off, you know, even under some amount of pressure. So good case for Julianas to continue to be involved in the U-20s as we get to the World Cup, because again, if the full pool is available, there's some real talent in that spot. And I feel like Yanez definitely made the case that he could play even when Amen and Weah and Carlton, you know, becomes maybe more available.
Yeah, you could see Yanez, you know, even if he doesn't end up starting being a first choice starter for that team, you could see him coming on midway through the second half against some tired legs and just making hay while the sun shines. He's very, very, very dangerous player, very technical, clever, creative. And what, he had like 9 goals, had about a goal every 15 minutes he played.
Yeah. And again, he had, just like I was praising Pomacall's setup play in the Mexico game, Yuli had some really impressive sort of table setting passes for other guys to get their goals.
It's almost indistinguishable which foot he's better with. He's so good with his left foot.
He's always right footed is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he had some, again, really impressive, whether they were cutbacks or finishes. The guy looks like he's got a lot going for him.
Okay. Well, those are the ones we're most excited about, or at least I'm most excited about. And, but we should mention that Paxton Pomacall, Justin Renix, Chris Gloucester, and Mark McKenzie all deserve attention for strong performances in this tournament. And they're all guys to keep an eye on in the spring. Juan Pablo Torres and Ayo Akinola, though, in my opinion, they're somewhat limited players. They proved that they were assets at this level, against this level of competition. Ayo got the game winner against Honduras and scored several goals. I can't remember the exact number. And I wouldn't be surprised if all of those names I just mentioned end up on the World Cup roster. And I wouldn't be disappointed with that.
Well, it's nice that that group performed the way they did, and they've given us another thing to look forward to with less trepidation. Like, I'm looking forward to the Gold Cup, but I'm also worried as hell about the Gold Cup. The U20 World Cup, I can really just sort of be enthusiastic about and just like keep appreciating what these guys are doing. Even the ones who are just sort of more serviceable, they're doing a really good job of being serviceable.
Yeah. Now, quickly on the Gold Cup, don't we get like quite a bit of a run up in the Gold Cup to the tough games? Isn't it kind of like the CONCACAF Championship was just for the U20s? Like, we'll have 3 easy games where we can sort of sort things out and then come to the tougher competition in the knockout round?
Yes and no. It'll depend on the draw a little bit, because even going from like the bad teams to the really bad teams, there can be these big gaps. And, we've had some, like we've, no, you're, I mean, you're right. The group stage of the U.S. has lost like one game in its history, but I think that was just in the last Gold Cup. And we've had issues against teams like Jamaica, where we're no longer we're no longer just running through it with ease until we get to Mexico. So, I would say no, like we aren't going to have, just sort of cakewalks, because it also can be really important to not just advance, but to like win your group. So there's not going to be any game where we're just like, okay, well, this will be a breeze. I mean, I'm thinking like what, 6 years ago where we struggled to beat Guadeloupe 1-0. Like we haven't been dominant enough recently enough where I'm feeling like anything can be taken for granted.
Okay. Well, consider me trepidated. Let's talk quickly about Tab Ramos's coaching job. What's your, we were pretty critical of the way the boys were playing early in the tournament. What's your take now that it's all over?
So I'm going to tie it back to the Sarakin business. I was critical of the tactics that Tab was using in the early stages of the game, but they were very, I think it was very clear what was being done, like what the kids were trying to do.
Yep, for sure.
And that means that Tab is able to articulate his plan to the kids. They're able to execute what he wants them to do. We can sort of nitpick and say, well, I don't want them to be doing that. I want them to look like Barcelona against the Caribbean islands. Tab chose to not fuss about and to just overwhelm them, just bulldoze the shit out of them. And again, what was the goal difference through the first? What was the goal difference for the full tournament?
I think it was 46-2.
Okay. So Tab will have something to stand on, I think, when people are criticizing, when people like us are criticizing his tactics. I will say that again, it was obvious that the team was employing Tab's tactics the way he wanted them to, and that is in a way is very much a credit to what Tab was doing.
Yeah, that's the key thing for me too. That 4-3-3 that he insists upon and has been playing for years and years now. It's very clear that the kids know what they're doing, and it's also seems to be a somewhat versatile formation. You know,
yeah. Like, game to game, there were clear changes, right? That Costa Rica game was a night and day difference in style of play.
Yeah. Yeah, and even when we faced Honduras, the game after that, in Honduras, you know, was basically playing not to lose 4-0. That was
mm-hmm. Yeah, they got themselves into the World Cup by doing that.
Yep. Pragmatic. We couldn't play tiki-taka through them because they had 10 guys behind the ball at all times, and so there was a little bit more of that lumping it to the corner. And you know, I don't blame Tab for that. You got to switch things up. And I thought, especially the interplay between the wingers and the fullbacks seemed to get better and better as the tournament went on. The introduction of Dest, I think, really helped with that because he's a little bit more sophisticated than the guys he replaced in possession. And yeah, I was really happy. People on the internet are talking about Tab as a better choice than Berhalter. It's one of the many things being talked about on the internet today and yesterday. I don't know. I don't have a strong feeling about Tab as the U.S. men's national team coach, other than that I figured he'd be a lot better than Sarakin.
Yeah, on the evidence there, definitely a better tactician/communicator than Sarakin. Well, I don't have a strong preference on either direction on Tab either. As I've made clear, I don't particularly have a strong preference on anyone who's in the top 10 candidates bandied about on the internet.
Well, Sarakin's in the top 10, so you're going to have to revise that statement.
Sarakin is not in the top. No, I don't believe in the internet anymore if Sarakin's still in the top 10. That Costa Rica game, man, that Costa Rica game would be the tape Tab would want to send into the committee. That was class. That was all the things that we wanted that we've been asking for. And it was in an important game where nothing had been settled yet. And the boys dominated.
Yeah, they sure did. And they broke it open with some moments of quality from Mackenzie, Mendez, and Yanez. I'm going to briefly tick off some things to look forward to with this group. We've talked about some of it already, but, you know, what is going to happen with Brandon Cervenia at Dallas? That's a question we can go into 2019 with. Will
Pomacall and Cervenia, right?
Yeah, Pomacall too.
Okay.
And will Alex Mendez get a Bundesliga debut in the spring? I don't think it's out of the question. Freiburg is doing okay. And, you know, they almost beat Werder Bremen this past weekend. He will almost certainly make his U19 debut, I believe, on February 3rd. So watch for that. And the DFB puts out their highlights a couple days after those weekend games. So maybe we'll get to see a Mendez Galazzo in the hills of the Black Forest on February 5th. What's going to happen with Chris Richards at Bayern? Is he gonna sign with them?
That, and we'll find that out in January, right?
We may find out before
the loan ends in January. Okay.
Yeah. The loan ends December 31st, I believe. But
okay,
you know, if they're going to sign him, hopefully they announce it before the end of the year. Sebastian Soto is one to keep watching at Hanover. Didn't have the best performances in the U20 tournament, but I still rate him pretty highly, and I imagine he'll be on the World Cup roster if he's released. And then will,
because you think Tab rates Soto, right?
Yeah, that's what I hear, and he's just a good presence on the team, and also, you know, he didn't find the back of the net in those two games, but that's never been a question with him finding the back of the net. He's a proven goal scorer at the levels that he's played at. I thought his hold up play wasn't quite as clean as I expected in those games against Costa Rica and Honduras. But like we said, the Honduras game was a tough one for us to break down. I just want to see, you know, I think he's going to get another chance, and I'm glad about that.
Okay. All right. Keep breaking them down. So Soto, we're going to keep watching at Hanover.
Yep.
Who's next?
Ulianis reported to be signing with Wolfsburg. Keep an eye on that. I believe he turns 18 in April. He wouldn't be able to play with them until fall. So the fall of 2019.
And I know you hate these legal questions. Would he be able to play with their U19s? Or I'm sorry, their U19s during the during the spring? Or does he can't do anything? He's in a sergeant situation where he just trains and...
I believe so. I mean, there could be some loophole somewhere, but that seems to be the general thing. If you have your birthday after the transfer window, the registration window, then you have to wait until the next window, which would be the summer window.
Okay.
And then the big one is Richie Ledesma, who did not play in this tournament, should be at PSV Eindhoven by January. And, you know, all reports are he'll slot right into the young PSV team, their reserve squad that plays in the second division of Dutch football. He is a big time man. If he can get back to health and regain his form, he should be one to watch very closely in the spring.
All right, man. That's an exciting group to add to our already sort of the sergeant watch and the Weah watch, because I kind of assume Weah is going to go on loan in January. So yeah, we have a lot of hashtag watches going on.
Yeah.
This spring.
Okay, thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you.